welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. I am here today with author Todd Fonstack, and pardon me, is that how you pronounce it? Because I
actually, you're really, really close. It's Fonstack technically, but I'll go with Fonstack over Fainstack or Falmastack or some of the others that I get.
Okay, great. Yeah, we met momentarily at 20 Books Vegas at the Rave event. 2 months ago now. Yeah. And yeah, so let's get to know you. I got a little bit of info before we hit record that you go on walks every morning. We can come around to that, or you can talk about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I talk about whatever you want to talk about. Yeah, no, I started doing walks. Gosh, it was almost 2 years ago now, where I just wanted to get something into my workout regime that I would look forward to. And I love watching the sunrise. So I just am sort of naturally getting up earlier and earlier, and I just go out and walk in the dark. And, you know, Denver in the middle of the night is actually kind of interesting for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the sunrise rising. But there's a trail that goes right along the Platte River, and it's just gorgeous. I mean, you wouldn't believe the wildlife that's in the middle of this city. And so it became this habit that now I'm walking 10 to 15 miles every morning. So it's wow. Hours and hours that I spend out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I bet that's productive time. Like you're thinking and developing ideas.
Absolutely. It's critical at this point. Not only am I thinking about ideas for stories, but also my assistant, Becca, who I think you've kind of met by email back and forth. She also is an early riser and also goes on walks in the morning. We've kind of sort of done this thing in tandem. So oftentimes we'll talk for an hour or more about business stuff, you know, cons that I'm going to, what we're going to set up for this next, doing podcasts, things like that happen. A lot of that business stuff happens in the morning.
Great. And what's your, can you tell us about your background, like education or previous career? A lot of authors sure. did something before they really broke through.
Yeah. I think every author I've ever met that's had even a little bit of success has had like, you know, a half dozen jobs before they got to where they were going. So I went to school in Durango. Actually, I have a Durango sweatshirt on today. Here, hang on. Okay. There we go. My Durango sweatshirt. Went to school at Durango High School. I went to college at the Colorado College in Colorado Springs, and then kind of went out adventuring for quite a long time. In my day, I have hung cables inside of drained oil tankers looking for cracks in the hull. I have waited tables, bus tables. I have worked as a PowerPoint, like the program PowerPoint operator at investment banking firms in New York City. I have worked at nonprofits such as the American Diabetes Association. So these are just some of the jobs that I've done in between when I graduated from high school and now where I'm writing full time.
Wow. And sorry, did you mention what, did you get a bachelor's? Did you get a, what your...
Yeah, my apologies. I got a bachelor's of arts degree in art studio. So drawing, painting, sculpting, also something that I have a little bit of skill in. Probably much less now than I did when I graduated because I use it every now and then. And I definitely use my design ability for covers and that sort of thing. I mean, I'm not the one that designs my covers, but I have a lot of heavy input on my covers, and I'm not the one that paints my covers. My artist Rashid Alakroka does my covers, and he's fabulous. So that's not me either. But we do a lot of talking about, you know, composition and what it's going to look like and that sort of thing. So my degree helps me in that particular respect as well.
Okay, I'm writing down your cover artist's name. I think I wrote it down before, but I forgot.
Yeah, Rashed. Rashid. Is his first name, and Alakroka, AALAKROKA. Yeah, you can find him on ArtStation. He's fantastic.
Okay.
Not only is he just getting better and better and better all the time as an artist, but he's a phenomenal human being as well. I really enjoy working with him.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm in the process of publishing my first book right now, and I already have a cover artist. But you know, maybe things fall through in the future. I actually sent another cover artist an email this morning, cause I ran into his work. I'm like, hey, you know, future reference, what are your rates like? So, but
yeah, for sure.
Okay. And how did you get into writing then?
So actually I was in high school. I wanted a fantasy novel with more action in it. That was what kind of drove me. It's like, I loved epic fantasy. Epic fantasy saved my life when I was 14. My parents got divorced and I kind of fell into this escapism. And rather than going around and, you know, vandalizing local game halls and things like that, I just sort of fell into the escapism of epic fantasy. And it really helped me through a tough time, which is why once I started, you know, just reading it, I was like, oh, I want more action in these. And that's when I thought, well, maybe I should write one. And so my senior year of high school, I had what's called an independent study. Mm-hmm. And my advisor, I think it was Brent Brown. Mr. Brown is how I knew him anyways. And essentially what it was is, if you know, you were a student of a certain academic standing, you could craft your own class. And I said, I want to write a book. He's like, great. And so I started writing, and I think I got maybe a third of the way done with the story before the end of my senior year. And I finished it up that summer. Oh,
we're having some network delay there. You said, oh, no. Something about designing your own course, and then you kind of cut out.
Yeah. So essentially, if you were a student of a certain academic standing, you could design your own course. And uh-huh. I said I wanted to write a novel. And so that last semester of my senior year, I wrote about a third of my very first epic fantasy novel. And then that summer, I remember that summer clearly. I remember the sort of blue and white flannel curtains blowing in the breeze, and typing away and finishing my very, very first book when I was 18. And I thought it was the best book ever. Plenty of action, that sort of thing. And it sucked. Uh-huh. It's so bad. It was so bad. But I didn't think it was bad, so I wrote a second one, which also sucked. But I thought it was good too, so I wrote a third one, Step and Repeat. I think it was about book 11 or 12 where I started publishing.
Uh-huh. Pardon me.
So that's
turn off Alexa.
That's how it started. That was how I first got into it. Was I wanted a book with more action, and I figured I could write a book with more action. You know, if you see something that hasn't been written and you want that thing, then write it yourself. And actually, interestingly enough, my brand tagline that I use now is "Edge of Your Seat Epic Fantasy," and it, you know, goes straight back to that moment.
Yeah, I saw that. I noticed that in your newsletter, and that's a good tagline.
Hey, thanks.
I made a tagline early last year. Early last year, and it's lousy. I need to come up with a new one, but it's like quality fiction for young and old.
Okay.
It's nice and cozy, you know, but it doesn't grab.
What's good about that is it's being clear about what you're giving them. You know, I mean, that's what's good about that particular tagline. But you know, hey, if something doesn't work exactly quite right, I mean, I find that my the things that I've done that didn't work out tend to teach me more than the things that I've done that did work out. And you just keep building on that, right? It's a pyramid, and my pyramid is like full of failures down here. You know, it's getting better and better as I go up towards the top of the pyramid, but it's the failures more than the successes, I think, that build what you can do in the future.
So how long, you wrote the first third of your first book, you said?
Yeah, I think so.
When you were 18, and how long did you have that before you published anything, or was that the first one you published, or?
No, this is back in the 80s. So there was no publishing unless you had a traditional publisher back then. There was no Amazon. There was no self-publishing. Even vanity presses didn't really exist. I mean, I suppose you could have worked it out if you knew somebody with that was in the industry. But no, I mean, either you had to get one of the big seven at the time publishers, or you were not published. So it was... Oh, gosh, it was 2001 when I first started sending things out to agents, and it was 2000 and Oh, wait, I take that back. The first time I was ever published was a short story, and I was in college. It was 1992, and it was a short story in the Dragonlance anthology, Tales 2, Volume 2, The Cataclysm. So it was a series of short stories from all different authors that were published in the Dragonlance world. Are you familiar with Dragonlance at all?
No.
Really big back in the 80s for people who were into fantasy. It was essentially one of the first fiction worlds that were created based on Dungeons and Dragons. So it was linked to TSR and Dungeons and Dragons. They were the ones that essentially put up the money to have these books be written. And so it was like using all of the things that we're familiar with in Dungeons and Dragons. All of the different characters were different classes. So it was not lit RPG, but it was in that vein, right? It was an epic fantasy novel with all of these classes and characters that you would recognize from the game. And it was hugely successful amongst the geeky set like myself back in the day. And so it was really a dream come true when I was in college and got the opportunity to work with Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman and do a short story for that anthology.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, I was a freshman in college, and my other geeky friends in college just thought that was the coolest thing ever that I was getting published in Dragonlance. Woo! And I think it's interesting that you read epic fantasy. I assume you read epic fantasy, right?
Yeah.
And that you don't know about Dragonlance just, you know, points out that you're a lot younger than I am, I think.
Well, it also that and that I don't keep myself abreast with I guess pop culture, even if we're in a subset of nerdy pop culture, but
gotcha.
Like you hear big names in fantasy stories, and there's so much I haven't read, to be frank. I
haven't read yet.
You know,
I'm with you. There's a lot that I haven't read as well.
I read all the Animorphs in the 90s.
See, so that's a little bit of pop culture.
Yeah. So what did you read back in the day? Cause like I got started on Wheel of Time in high school, and, I've listened to a lot of Brandon Sanderson, on my commute, you know?
So, yep. The audiobooks. Yeah. He's got some fantastic audio narrators for that. Yeah. So my stuff, when I was growing up, the things I loved the most, I got started with Lloyd Alexander, and he wrote this thing called The Chronicles of Prydain. And so that was my first, I think it was a 5-book set, The Book of Three, Castle of Lear, Black Cauldron. Actually, you know, the Disney movie, The Black Cauldron, was based on one of the books from that series. It wasn't that great of a movie, but I was very excited that it was actually based on one of those books. That was one of the beginning points. The Sword of Shannara by Terry Brooks. Terry Brooks was hugely influential to me early on. I loved that book. I hadn't even read The Lord of the Rings yet when I read Sword of Shannara. So I loved that. I loved The Elf Stones of Shannara, and of course The Wish Song, which came afterwards. A lot of Piers Anthony. I read a lot of Piers Anthony, The Chronicles of Xanth, and Split Infinity. What was that? The Apprentice Adept series. Read that when I was younger. And then, of course, Dragonlance was huge for me. And I ended up meeting Margaret Weiss at one point, which is how I got into that anthology. The Dragonlance Chronicles were also big. Did you get the Piers Anthony that I mentioned, the Xanth Chronicles. Yeah. So then also Dragonlance was also big.
Okay. And so how you started submitting manuscripts to publishers in like 2001, and how many books do you have published now?
So by July of this year, I will have 27. Currently I have 25, but I've got one coming out in February, one coming out in July.
Do you have kind of a regular pace that you produce on?
No, this is one of my Achilles heels as a writer. I mean, I would love to be one of those guys that writes a book every quarter or, you know, has 3 books a year consistently. I am such a sprinter. So I'm streaky, right? So like I will have moments where I'm just kind of percolating and then boom, all right, you know, 2 books in 3 months. So that's what I'm trying to do now for my fans is sort of create that that regular interval. Well, so, go ahead.
I was going to say I think my comment on that will segue us into our topic for discussion for today. So you go ahead and then I'll give my comment.
Okay, cool. So yeah, so rather than putting out like, you know, 5 books 1 year and 1 book the following year and 4 books after that and no books the following year, I mean, what I'm trying to do is build a pipeline so that I'm going to release in February, release in July. And mm-hmm. every year I'll put out 2 books. And if my pipeline gets, you know, 4 books deep, then I'll start releasing 3 books a year is probably what I'll start doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I, you know, I mentioned I'm publishing my first novel currently. I've set the public launch date for February 28th. Have not yet uploaded the manuscript to the platforms where it will be available on that date because it's not finalized yet. I sent it to beta readers last Saturday, you know?
Oh, good for you.
But thank you. So I always wanted to write, you know, and I wrote a few things growing up, not often because I hesitate to say a lazy streak in me. And it's because I have, so many different interests and I recognize that this interest will take time and work to get into, to get anywhere with. So I'm like, oh, I'll do something easier, you know? I actually wrote a few things, not many things growing up. And then, I will come back around to my comment.
Yeah, no, this is great.
So my wife got me into NaNoWriMo, in 2009. Ah, cool. And I didn't know how to write a book at the time. And I got like 1500 words in and didn't, get any farther. And then the next year I tried again. I got a little bit farther this time, but I had a really cool idea. I thought it was a really cool idea and it actually came to me in a dream, but, so my 2010 NaNoWriMo, I held on to and determined to come back to it and actually finish that someday. It's not finished yet, but, I'm about 34,000 words into it and things going on in my former career, set kind of determined a timeline where I was going to go ahead and I'll be a full-time author, even though I don't have anything published yet, as of last month. So as of last month, I left, I was in the Marine Corps active duty. So I mm-hmm. left that and, leading up to that, I was able to take advantage of a program that allowed me to participate in, what's the word? An internship for a few months. And I set my 2010 NaNoWriMo aside because it's too complex and I care about it too much. It's going to have to be, I'm going to be pretty exacting with myself, which means I'll be too slow. And I shoved my way through something else. An idea that I had last year. Wait, nope. I had it in 22. And then I started writing in early 23. Well, I started forming the idea in early 23 and, started really writing it early autumn of last, of 2023. And so now when I was on this internship, I was able to dedicate time to writing this book and I pushed it out. It took me about 2 months, 80,000 words, approximately, wow. You know, same like this Harry Potter. And I finished it. I finished that. I reached the end and I was kind of shocked because, you know, before I would share like, you know, here's a passage or here's a little piece of my story. What do you think of that? But now, like, as soon as I hit the end, I'm like, whoa, that's supposed to be the book. And now I feel insecurities that I didn't feel before. But, since then I have not started writing book 2 And so you talk about doing sprints. I feel that. I have been, in my defense, I have been extremely busy getting ready for this transition and doing this transition. And we're still moving into the house that we bought and technically moved into last year. If I showed you around the room, it would be a mess. Like, we're not settled in yet. So I've had a lot of things preventing me from getting there. And now, like, publishing book one has been taking all this time. And and I'm running a Kickstarter campaign for it also.
Oh, cool.
It actually already reached funding. I launched it January 1st, reached funding after about 4 days. But it's still live until the end of January. And anyway, so it's been taking a lot of time because I'm trying to do things
on the Kickstarter funding.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool.
So I'm really trying hard to launch this book the right way so that if people, want to know more about me or want to know what I'm doing, like, things are in place. I have a newsletter, and I actually started the newsletter in 2021, technically, but I just barely started, going regular, as in I have declared I'm doing it bi-weekly, and I have had two newsletters 2 weeks apart. So there we go. That's set the pattern. So there's the newsletter, there's this podcast, and all this stuff going on. Soon I'll be able to write the second book, but I hope that I can write it faster than I wrote the first book, because while I was writing the first book, I hit some hangups because I had a concept for the broad arc for the novel, for the book. And I set up things happened in the beginning to set off the plot, and main character got started on her journey and she got into her journey. And then now what, you know? So there was a lot of banging my head against the wall. Like, I need to write, I need to put this out, because I was doing this internship and I had, I had kind of a mentor who had said, you know, shoot for 2,000 words a day. So I had word count goals, and this internship was why I wasn't showing up for work at the Marines every day. So I had to be accountable and I had to reach my word count goals. And I'm like, what am I writing today? I don't even know, because I didn't plan the next scene. So, yes, I intend to carefully set out a plan for book two and for the rest of the series. And then I hope to see my progress go through book two a lot faster than book one, because I don't have any published works yet. February 28th, that's going to be the first one. And I need these books to produce income, or I'm going to have to go and work for somebody else again. And I shared this online recently in a place that I don't really talk about. And somebody said, go get a real job. Well, this is a real job. It's so much work. But
yeah, sure.
I'm working at my discretion, you know, and that is huge for me. And I want to push these stories out.
And, you know, that's the way to do it. You know, you gotta plant your flag and say, this is where I'm at, and just go for it. I mean, and it's that persistence and that just constant going after it. That's the only way to do it, as far as I can tell.
So since, I was frustrated because I didn't have a clear enough idea what would happen in the middle of the book. I actually wrote the ending before I got stuck in the middle. And that brings us to the topic of planning versus pantsing or discovery,
okay.
Right? Which is what, your assistant said would be a great topic for you to talk about. And what are your thoughts on that? Plotting versus pantsing in epic fantasy.
Yeah, I'm a kind of a dyed in the wool pantser. However, I think it's important to expand your repertoire, right? So I did actually, for a number of years, look at, okay, how do I plot something out so that I can have both tools to work with, right? Mm-hmm. And so I highly recommend Save the Cat Writes a Novel, also Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, the one that started it all. Fantastic how-to book on putting together a structure that you can kind of like go. Are you familiar with Save the Cat?
I've heard a little bit about it. I haven't investigated deeply, but it's the idea of having the main character have a moment of decision early on.
That sounds more like The Hero's Journey. That's Joseph Campbell's thing, which is also a really fantastic piece to use when constructing a story. But Save the Cat was a screenplay how-to book that Blake Snyder wrote, gosh, back in the 90s, I want to say. And it was not only great for screenplays, but it was great for storytelling in general. And then Jessica Brody followed it up several years later with a Save the Cat Writes a Novel, which essentially takes all of the exact same principles that Blake Snyder talks about and sort of forms them more for a novel. I love them both. I think they're both fantastic how-to books. And it's not exactly a plotter's book. It's not. It's a creating a structure for both pantsers and plotters. So, I mean, at this point, one of the things that I'll do when I start a book is I will try and kind of fit them into the beat sheet of Save the Cat. I mean, I'll have an idea. That's always the way it starts. And then that idea could be anywhere in the book. It could be the first chapter. It could be the last chapter. It could be the 21st chapter. It could be anything in there that gets me inspired to start thinking about story. And then I start thinking about the structure of the story, because at a certain point I cross the threshold. I mean, as a writer, you always you're creating a cathartic experience for yourself, right? I mean, you're putting your emotions on the page. You have to put your emotions, your concerns, your worries, your fears, your triumphs, all that stuff. That's the best fodder for a story. And so we have to do that, which makes it a very sort of self-involved process. But I feel at a certain point as a professional, you have to start thinking about your audience, and you have to start doing things specifically for your audience, because that's part of the whole thing. It's not just about you kind of having this catharsis with your own emotions. It's about creating a presentation, an entertainment for other people. And in that, you're not just working alone. You're working with an audience, right? And you want to meet that audience. You want to match that audience and make sure that they're getting what they need. So when I got to that point, that's when I was like, okay, who knows about how to connect with an audience, and started looking into these various different books of people that have kind of gone there before. And Save the Cat was my favorite of those. And essentially it just gives you a structure to create emotional impact that is really going to serve your audience, be they viewers or readers, whatever it is. It gives you the opportunity to serve them even better. You're putting out the thing that is the book of your heart, but you're also making sure that connects up with what people want.
We just so had
that's,
another
that's my another hat tip to another blip. Okay.
We had another connection.
So connecting with the reader is the connection kind of went out for a little while.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, in summary, what I was saying was that this nod towards structure is in an effort to not only do the thing that you want to do, but also be able to connect it well and effectively for people who want to read your books. So in that respect, I felt learning a little bit more about plotting might help me. Although I have found that I vacillate back and forth. Like, I'll plot something out and the first third of the story, I will follow 90% of that plot. The second third of the story, I will follow 50% of that plot. And by the last third of the story, it's only 10% that I'm following. So I'm really reverting to my pantser roots in the end. Yeah. And I love that, because when I pants, I surprise myself. And if you couch it in the right structure and you surprise yourself, you're going to surprise your reader.
Yeah. Well, and I think there, you should have a kind of a combination attack between plotting and pantsing, or some people don't like the term. I think it's fine.
I like the term
discovery writing.
Yeah. I think it's fairly
easy to your pants anyway. Yeah. So I think it's good to have kind of a combination, because I think with a plan, you have an idea of where you're going, and So with my 2010 NaNoWriMo story, the concept came to me in a dream, right? And I woke up, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. But there was no plot there, you know? And so I'm kind of telling the background upon which the plot gets painted. And I found out pretty quickly that I got to a point and I'm like, I need somewhere to go with this. Like, what is going to happen? So I had to take a step back. Like, all right, so we have these princes and princesses who have these mystical weapons. What bad could happen? Oh, you know, maybe there's a rival nation that is jealous and there's a conflict there going on. So kind of drawing from that, I built a large overarching, I guess, story arc. But then it has to be fleshed in. And if you try to plan everything just from, like, if you don't do any discovery writing whatsoever and you only purely plan everything, that means you're looking from the beginning to the end. You're determining what happens in the middle so that we can get there, and you're going to be working smaller and smaller and planning the inner details of what happens along the way to get there. But that's going to be exhaustive and or exhausting, and you're not going to be able to do it. Also, you might come up with things that just aren't realistic. Like, you're hammering in plot devices that might not fit in a scene. Whereas when you're pantsing it, you're placing yourself in the scene. At least this is my experience. You place yourself in the scene and you're like, I'm this character. What am I doing? And I know that I want to go over there. What's going to happen on the way? Because I know that I can't just teleport and things will have to happen. So let's kind of imagine through the process. And then you have to marry them in the middle somewhere, where if you just purely pants, I think, then you might wander aimlessly and you might write an interesting book about the architecture of the town your main character lives in. And then your character's just, I don't know. And I'm rambling, but, I have found some things, some details, some things that happen in the story that I've discovered along the way, 'cause I'm in that scene and I had no concept that this was going to be a thing, but I come out of that scene like, that was cool. That should come back later. And so the pantsing experience is now influencing the planning experience. It reflects
right. Back and forth. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I talked too much. We're supposed to be talking today.
No. I mean, these are all like the growth moments of writing a novel. You're right on track.
So how would you tie this into epic fantasy specifically, into your genre?
How would I tie pantsing versus plotting?
Yeah. How does that experience percolate in your case?
Well, like I said, oftentimes I will, you know, be thinking about ideas for a very long time, and when I'm ready to put them onto the page, then I just start in. And I kind of like do a little bit of pantsing to start, and then I will probably then go back and try and plot most of it or as much of it as I can stand before I need to get in and start writing the story again. And so, you know, you talked a little bit about marrying it up in the middle. That's kind of what happens. I'll do a little bit of plotting and then sort of marry up what I've discovered in the story as I've gone along with the pantsing part of it, and then hook that into plotting, which probably, you know, dyed-in-the-wool plotters would be like, that's not plotting. That's actually not plotting at all. that's just pantsing. But I do feel that there's a little bit of structure that I impose upon it as I'm going. So I don't know. I kind of consider myself to be a bit of a hybrid in that respect. Although there have been a couple times where I've laid out an entire book ahead of time. Not many times, but a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I definitely intend to, I guess I'm, I put myself more on the side of being a plotter.
Okay.
Like I got hung up in the middle of Nightshade Unicorn Forerunner because I didn't have a plan for what was going to happen next. And I was kind of scared to wing it and come up with something that wasn't going to work well. And in the end, like I kind of had to wing it. I guess I did a little bit of discovery writing to push myself past the hang up. But within the confines of what I had in mind for the future. And I forgot where I was going with this, but, oh, what was it? As you were saying that you try to marry it up. I mean, yeah, I said that you agreed. Oh, that with pantsing, you do some things that don't occur to you while you're plotting, at least for me. While I'm planning the story arc, I'm not planning the jokes that this one character is going to tell, you know?
Sure, of course not.
And if there's a character that's being funny and he cracks a joke, it could be something off the wall, and it could be it could introduce an interesting idea that deserves to come back. Maybe not a great example, but
yeah, no, I mean, I find that my subconscious actually seems to keep track of a lot more stuff than my conscious mind keeps track of. I will find that, I mean, even over the course of 220,000 word novels, I'll start something in one and then it will seem to come to fruition in the second novel, right? Which just, it still blows my mind that like, and it comes across like this windfall. Like I'm just kind of cruising along in the second book and going, oh, wow, this hooks up really cool to this thing that I did over here. I didn't expect that. That's so cool. And I find it happening over and over and over again. And if it had just happened once, I'd be like, oh, well, that's a lucky break. But I really do think that as people, and Dean Wesley Smith talks about this a lot, like as people, we are indoctrinated with story from the get-go, from the cradle, from the moment we can watch TV, we are being indoctrinated with story. So we know this stuff down to our bones. I mean, we know it without even thinking about it. And especially if you're a storyteller that's been doing stories for a while, I mean, it is ingrained in you to think these things. And so one of the things that Dean Wesley Smith talks about is to trust yourself that you do know story and that it's coming around. He's a big pantser, Dean Wesley Smith is. Mm-hmm. And so this notion that if you lean into the things that are exciting you, they're going to lay themselves out in a way. I mean, you're going to have to go back and you're going to have to revise. And goodness gracious, I can talk about all the times that I wrote a novel and there were fatal flaws a quarter of the way in. And I had to uproot the entire thing and rewrite the entire thing all the way. That sucks. But the more you do, the more you write, the better you get at that sort of thing. And so more often than not, I haven't had a fatal flaw in a book where I just had to redo almost the entire thing in a while. It's been years since that has happened to me. Cause it's like you do it enough times and you see it coming ahead of time. It's like, oh, nope, can't go down this rabbit hole because that's not going to connect up in the end. Or maybe it's that we pantsers get so resilient that even if it does go down the rabbit hole, we find a way to twist it and turn it and bring it back and then create this whole new subplot of the story that's very interesting and tasty. So, I mean, it can work really well both ways, I think.
How do you approach your world building and magic systems in the frame of in light of plotting versus pantsing?
One step at a time. Oftentimes I'll have an idea. Like a lot of stuff that comes to me comes in the microcosm. So I'll have a scene in my head. Let's just take, for example, you've got this ballroom and I can see it clearly. I'm very visual, right? So I can see it clearly. It's a white and black checkered floor. You've got people in very fancy, ridiculous, sort of like fashion runway kind of attire, right? You know, I mean, these dresses and, you know, suits that you would never wear anywhere else except at this party, right? And they're all very, you know, stiff backed and they're dancing and every single one of them has a shaved head. They're all like bald, right? And like, maybe they have makeup or things, you know, off of their eyebrows. Just, I mean, this really ridiculous. So this will come to me and I'll be like, wow, that's really cool. And then my logistics mind will go to work. It's like, okay, so what kind of cultural influences would lead to people dressing up their eyebrows with like maybe extensions like a, you know, a handlebar mustache or with glitter or with wires attached to them, making them outrageously big and long and wide? Like what would lead to something like that? And that's when I start building the history. So it's like this microcosm that I start with, and then I start building out from that all of the things that would support this ridiculous thing that has come to pass. Because, you know, fantasy, part of fantasy is you get to make whatever you want. The more ridiculous you can make it, the more readers are going to love it if you could give a good reason for it. If you can make a plausible suspension of disbelief for why people have intricate eyebrows and shaved heads in this, you know, this ballroom dancing scene. And that could then rise to a million other things, right? Once you start, oh, well, long ago, the sun was very hot. We've since controlled that. But back then, people with larger eyebrows, it would shade their eyes. I mean, I don't know. I mean, people, I think the thing about readers with fantasy, they want to believe. They want to believe. That's why they're reading fantasy. If they wanted to believe in the wonder of love and romance and sex, they would read romance novels. But they're reading fantasy novels, which means they want to believe in the spectacular, the wondrous, right? And so you give them a good enough reason to believe, and they will. They'll follow you. But it has to be good enough, because I can't tell you that the most disappointing thing is people, A, don't pay attention to it at all. Like, they don't give any reasons for why things might be ridiculous, or they give a bad reason, you know, a reason that's like, yeah, I don't think so, you know? But I mean, it seems to me that the most bizarre is oftentimes the fertile ground for the greatest book, you know? Mm-hmm. Jim Butcher once said something that was really interesting. He said, you are far more, Jim Butcher writes the Dresden novels. I don't know if you're familiar, but great guy. Met him a couple times at Superstars writing seminars. Anyways, he says you are far more in danger of losing your reader's attention than you are of the reader going, well, that's just ridiculous. I'm not going to believe in that. Like you, and yet that's what we writers tend to think. It's like, oh, this is too overblown. They're never going to believe that. But I love that shift of perspective, that it's like, it's far more likely that people are just going to be like, ooh, and put your book down, then they are going to be like, oh, that's just too outrageous. I can't possibly read any more of this fantasy. It's too fantastical. Like that's much less likely, even though that seems much more likely in our minds.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a good point. Because if they're looking for the fantastical, if they're reading fantasy, they're looking for things that are outside of the realm of everyday life.
So that's why they showed up in the first place for this particular genre.
That makes me think of a book by what's his name? I beta read for him several years ago, and I'm gonna plug his name for him. Starts with a D. Dale Britton. Dale Britton.
Okay.
The book was The World I Know, and it's a guy who keeps accidentally universe hopping to other versions of himself.
Oh, cool.
And he hops farther and farther from his own world, and at first their things are just a little different, you know? And as he hops farther, things are more and more different till it gets to a point where things are just utterly bizarre. And it's still like a different version of himself, but the like people are clear. I don't remember. But it was really interesting. And I wasn't there to discount or discredit like, oh no, this world is too fantastical. I was there to learn about like this fascinating concept where people are clear and, I don't know, but it was an interesting book.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah. Now are your magic systems, do they tend to be, hard or soft, to use Brandon Sanderson's terms, or would they be, rational or irrational, to use C.R. Owenson's terms?
Gosh. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up Clark. I love Clark. He's great. I think I would assume that they're much softer, but I actually think that Clark would probably say that they're harder than I think that they are. I mean, they're usually, I have some mechanics to it. And if the magic doesn't obey the mechanics, then it doesn't work. So that's probably more on the hard side of things where, you know, if I'm remembering his system correctly, soft magic is like Superman can fly because of the sun, you know, like, cool. We're ready to buy into the fact that Superman can fly, but that's a fairly soft magic system. Whereas, you know, Brandon Sanderson, Mistborn, it's like, you know, you can use magic because you have this certain type of genetic ability that if you swallow a certain type of metal, it will do a certain type of thing for you. So there's like a definite system built up. I would say I probably lean more towards that.
Okay.
Like, for example, in my Threadweaver series, the whole concept of it is that, so imagine that when the gods built the world, it was like a three-dimensional tapestry. So essentially like a tapestry, except, right, everybody is moving and walking around, right? And that everybody is made up of these threads that make them on the tapestry. So they're like a tapestry, like, which is a two-dimensional piece of art, and a sculpture, which is a three-dimensional piece of art sort of combined together, right? Everybody's walking around and we're on this huge three-dimensional tapestry that is made up of threads, but nobody can see the threads unless you're a thread weaver and that you've been suffused with what's called the God Spill, which is this magical stuff that came out of where the gods lived a long time ago and saturated the world. And some people can see the threads, the sort of building blocks of what the gods did when they made this three-dimensional tapestry, and some people cannot. Now, if you can, then there's various levels of ability to be able to then manipulate it. So you got to be able to see it first. Once you can see it, then maybe you can pull a thread, you can twist a thread, you can change the color of a thread, and every single thing that you do to this thread or group of threads then has a counterpart reaction in the real world, right? So if you pull a thread really hard, the thing that's attached to that thread or the thing that's comprised of that thread flies across the air. So then it looks like telekinesis, right? So this is the, you know, one of the magic systems that I came up with for one of the series that I have written called Thread Weavers.
Yeah. And it's fun. And I do both, I guess. So with the Grand Hill Chronicles that I've named the podcast after, that's my 2010 NaNoWriMo story, is the Grand Hill Chronicles. Yeah. And that's going to be hard. Like, it's going to be, everything is determined ahead of time by me. What is, like, how things work. But with Nightshade Unicorn, when this podcast releases on February 1st, so, you know, audience is listening to us February 1st. My Kickstarter campaign will have ended last night for Nightshade Unicorn. And since I've written book one, I still need to plan through properly. I have a very loose idea for the arcs for the rest of the series. But I have said that, you know, male and female unicorns have different powers, and the males can do this and the females can do this with their magic.
Cool.
But there is a rift that divides them in the story. And
divides the male and female unicorns?
Yes. So actually, at the beginning, the status quo at the beginning of the book is that everybody thinks unicorns are all female. They've never seen a male unicorn. Yeah, because they are divided from each other, their separate powers are all they can do, except if they could come together, that enables more things that I haven't defined for the reader, let alone, I mean, I haven't even decided myself, let alone defined for the reader. That's going to be a softer or irrational system where you're not certain that they can do this unless you've seen them do this, or the characters have discussed that they did this thing, you know? I like how C.R. Rowenson, and actually when this podcast comes out, he'll have been on the podcast last week. Although I haven't recorded that yet. He talks about Harry Potter as irrational magic system. Like, and he mentions the Expelliarmus spell specifically. Like, we know that it can eject a wand from an opponent's hand, but what if they're holding a book or a gun? Like, does it work on that? Don't know, because we haven't seen it.
Right, right.
Anyway. I guess we should probably start wrapping up. But before we do, where can listeners find you on the web?
Yeah, so toddfonestock.com, T-O-D-D, and then my last name's a little bit hard to spell, but it's all one word, Todd Fahnestock, T-O-D-D-F-A-H-N-E-S-T-O-C-K.com. And that's got all of my books, all of my you can actually buy ebooks straight off the website if you want. But everything that I've done is there. You can also buy them off Amazon. You can buy them anywhere. But you can see them all collected all together at my website, toddfonestock.com.
And when is your next book coming out?
February 7th. So it's right around the corner. It's the fourth book in the Eldros Legacy series, which is a multi-author, shared world, mega epic experience where four founding authors, Quincy J. Allen, Marie Whitaker, Mark Stallings, and myself all came together to form this world. And each one of us has a continent, and it's a fantastic, huge epic fantasy experience. And there's a lot of cohort authors also, non-founders that have actually written books in the world. So it's a really, if you love epic fantasy, you'll love it. It starts with Kyven the Unkillable. That's the first in my Legacy of Shadows storyline.
It sounds great. And I actually jumped onto the beta for another book. What was it called? And so the one that beta is happening soon. When is that going to come out? Is that going to be
of my book, Slater and the Dragon? Yeah.
Slater and the Dragon. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. Read the first three or?
No, I haven't read anything yet.
Oh, you should probably at least read the first one.
Okay.
Because this is the fourth in the series, but okay. You're certainly welcome to beta read it. You might be a little bit lost if you didn't read at least the first book, if not the first three.
Okay.
I don't know how fast of a reader you are, but if you can jam in those three books in the next week or so, you'll be better off.
Okay, cool. And so for listeners, go to toddfonestock.com. I'll put that link in the show notes on YouTube and whatever podcatcher or podcast app everybody uses. And I think, for the listeners, I'll have some more announcements after the interview, but I'll add that later so I don't use your time. But yeah, I think that wraps that up. All right, by way of announcements, today is February 1st, and I am recording this actually on February 1st. I've had a lot been going on the past few days, so I wasn't able to do my editing and scheduling the episode ahead of time. We have our home internet down, so while I'm posting this from my phone, which is extremely inconvenient because I do the editing on my desktop. Anyway, so yesterday, or technically this morning, early this morning, the Kickstarter campaign concluded, and we did maintain funding level through to the end, which is awesome. And I need to send out a thank you to all the backers who supported the project. I'll be working on fulfilling the rewards for all of those, and you can track that on Kickstarter if you like. Another thing is that the cover art is nearly done. I pushed out on Twitter and Facebook. I shared the nearly done version of the cover art, and you can see that on Facebook if you follow author T.S. Pedramon, or on Twitter, it's also author T.S. Pedramon, but if you want the tag, that's at Grant Hill Cron. The Facebook, I think, is also at Grant Hill Cron. Anyway, So that's there. And I'm going to go ahead and push this episode out today. So I'm not going to sit around and think of what else I can announce. So anyway, we'll catch you next week on the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast.